talked about how the artist made her feel captive, and how she served him and felt hollow. I listened when she told about sitting naked on the patio so he could look at her. Miss Finch often murmured that he wasn't a very nice man, but mostly he made me feel small. He made me think about the strangeness of the world and how very large it must be. I thought about Paris, France, a place full of buildings full of pictures, and I was stumped. Nothing I heard in the Picasso book related to Honey Creek, and yet I couldn't help remembering the people and how they were tied to each other. I got off the school bus every afternoon and went straight to Miss Finch's house. There were a couple of people who took care of her, made her meals and gave her baths, and her son came home from his engineering job in the evening. But she was alone in the afternoons, and she got lonesome. You could tell. Her blind, filmy eyes even looked excited when she figured I was in her room. She told me she had been a great reader all her life, that she gobbled books like candy, until her eyes went bad. "My dear," she said, "treasure your eyes and all that you behold." I looked out the window and saw May in the distance cutting the lawn in her curlers and her apron. I thought I saw rocks being thrown up from under the machine. I saw her stop and lift something out of the grass, knowing it was probably a rabbit's nest or blind baby mice, which she would take inside and put in a warm oven and nurse with a doll's bottle. At first I felt like I had to be prim around Miss Finch. Sit up straight and pull up my socks, make sure I sat like a lady. But then it came to me that she couldn't see one single thing. I stuck my tongue out at her as fast as I could. Nothing. Those eyes of hers were looking in two different directions. She didn't care what I looked like, or if I abused her until kingdom come. So I lay on the floor with my head on a pillow, like princesses get to. Plus I sucked on the hard candies Miss Finch had by her bed. I tried to get candy out of the jar without Miss Finch hearing, but she always said, "Help yourself," right when I had my greedy hands on the loot. Her ears were extra perked up. Sometimes I ran all the way from the school bus with my bag over my shoulder slapping my back. I couldn't wait to hear the next chapter. I dreamed about the plots all day long without once touching down to real life. Once, we were listening to a book called The Mill on the Floss, and we were finally, after 20 reels, right near the end. I had a terrible feeling about Maggie, that her days were numbered, and that water was going to be responsible. I couldn't bear it. I thought about her constantly at school, hoping the best, although my heart told me she didn't have a chance in the world. I bumped into people in the halls, and they pushed me away with their elbows. They didn't know Maggie was the only person on my mind. I was desperate to hear the end. I raced down the school bus stairs and tore along the road while the boys leaned out the windows jeering at me. I took the porch steps by twos. I didn't even call, "Hello, hello." I was out of breath, heaving and gasping. I said, "Hi, Miss Finch." I couldn't keep it straight that she was married once and that her real name was Mrs. Finch. "Is that you, my dear?" she asked. She didn't wait for an answer. She said, "I don't feel up to reading today. Why don't you and I have a little chat?" "Huh?" I said. I couldn't believe it. I stood there staring into her useless eyes. It seemed that every time we got to the juicy part in a book, Miss Finch wanted to talk. I wasn't going to listen to her mouth run on. I scowled and flapped my hands with my thumbs sticking in my ears. I hated for her to start in her slow, tired voice about how great it all was back when she was a girl in New England, and how they always ate Boston baked beans, and she shoved the beans into a little drawer in the table because she couldn't stand to eat them. I plugged up my ears, but I couldn't keep my fingers in my eardrums all afternoon, and pretty soon the book magic occurred. That is, I sat there with my mouth hanging open, greedy for what she was talking about. She always said, "My dear, I'll tell you about the good memories. I don't have any use for the unhappiness I've had in my life." She told me about her husband Mel and his massive coronary attack. He was sitting at dinner, and he dumped over into his chicken salad. She told me about their trips, all the beautiful islands, and living in the memories made her cry for the lost pleasures. She had a whole set of photo albums. My job was to describe each picture, and then she told me about where they took place. There were pictures of lobsters she ate and girls doing the hula dance. She went all over the world because Mel was a merchant. I'd go to the islands with her, sitting right by the bed, and remember my favorite parts for her. I started to bring Aunt Sid's letters over to Miss Finch because she liked anything at all from the outside. I think I can imagine how it would be, not seeing a thing except all your past life swirling around in your brain. Any noise would be magnified. The clang of silverware, the mice scratching in the walls, the cats knocking paint cans over on the porch. All vibrations carrying noise long after it stopped. Miss Finch was always looking alarmed, saying, "What's that?" when I hadn't heard anything at all. So just as it used to be with Miss Penn, Miss Finch got acquainted with Aunt Sid. Miss Finch, Aunt Sid, and I were a family, always eager to know the news about each other. Aunt Sid wrote me more about her life, now that I was older. She talked about her job teaching music at the high school in DeKalb. She said sometimes she closed her eyes while she conducted, and she saw flocks of blackbirds leaving the basswood tree at the home farm in one gust. And then all of a sudden, she had to perk up, because she realized the students were singing their song without mistakes. Sid was more than your average conductor. She had no children of her own, since she never did get married, despite her stunning looks. She probably had so many offers she didn't know who to pick. She wrote me about the pale green evening dress she wore for the spring concert, plus the white lily pinned to her chest. She had to stand on a platform with her arms stretched out like a goose flapping its wings right before takeoff. And when she brought her arms up in a certain way, all the singers opened their mouths and blasted the audience to pieces. Miss Finch wouldn't have been able to tolerate such a thing. The students usually sang songs by dead composers. Then, after they were finished, Aunt Sid had to turn around and bow to the parents. The entire auditorium rose up clapping and stomping their feet. I asked Aunt Sid to write and tell me every little thing in her life, because I wanted to breathe with her. And Miss Finch did, too. She described the time she went to Chicago and heard a singer named Leontine Price. She said she had dreams that she herself was a black opera star, and when she woke up, she was awfully disappointed. I was shocked. I couldn't stand to think of Aunt Sid as a Negro. I read the letters to Miss Finch, and she'd say, "Ask Aunt Sid what her house looks like." So I had to write Aunt Sid, "Don't send a picture, because remember, Miss Finch is stone blind. She can't see her own nose." I confess that I stuck my tongue out at her just to make sure. When I got Aunt Sid's letters, I ran over and ripped them open, and then I read the news to Miss Finch. There was the one summer Aunt Sid took a group to Europe. They sang songs and people threw flowers at them. Before they left the U.S., they sold thousands of grapefruits to raise money, and it had to make me wonder if the grapefruits were those Elmer picked way down in Texas. It had to make me think that somehow, in a strange way, there are a few binding strands between us. Picture it. Aunt Sid selling Elmer's grapefruits to go to Europe, to sing songs to the communists so she can write me, so I can read the letters to Miss Finch and add something new to her brain. It's all a big old chain. There isn't one unconnected link. There were parts of the letters I didn't read to Miss Finch. I'd skip sections like this. I know how hard it is to be a teenager. There is so much going on inside a person's head and heart. It is sometimes difficult for me to watch my students struggling through adolescence. I think it is much harder for your generation than it was for mine. You sound as if you have a good friend in Miss Finch. I'm so glad you can share all the lovely books. I don't think I could have survived if I hadn't discovered the library in Stillwater and Miss Oglesby, the choir director, who told me repeatedly that I had a good voice. Still, it is books that are a key to the wide world. If you can't do anything else, read all that you can. I didn't have much luck reading to myself because my eyes weren't extra strong. I needed glasses, but May said she didn't have the money for the optician. I wrote to Aunt Sid and said how adolescence, that's what she called it, wasn't so bad. I told her that every minute I could, I was out of the house, at Miss Finch's, and that when May talked to me, I pretended I was far away. And then her voice came to me like it was a thin column of smoke from way over on the other side of the mountain. That's what I said. Although we don't have mountains in Illinois, except Starved Rock, where some people didn't have food and they died. I wrote Aunt Sid about how I walked out into the night, back through the cow pasture and up into the woods, to the plateau where there are a few cedar trees and long wild grasses. I lay on the ground looking up to the sky, and sometimes I got the queerest feeling. I could sense the earth spinning around, and I felt small, probably how a midget feels in a room with regular people. For a split second, I had the sensation all through my body that there wasn't a reason for our being on the planet. We were hurtling through space, and there wasn't any logic to it. It was all for nothing. Such a thought made me feel so lonesome, I had to turn over on my stomach and cry for all the world. I cried for the little lamb we had once that lost its hind leg in a dog attack. It had to hobble around the yard bleating, waiting for someone to feed it corn. I cried for it, and the hungry people on top of Starved Rock, and Miss Finch's blind eyes, and how long and soft the grasses were that I lay in. I cried for the loveliness in the night. I couldn't stop the flow, because I knew if Aunt Sid ever saw me for an extended period of time, not counting her short yearly visits out of duty, she'd change her mind about liking me. Adolescence, it isn't so bad, I wrote Aunt Sid, even though I could tell she knew I was in all the dumb classes. I had the feeling she knew I cried up on the plateau at night, in the grass, that I felt just as fragile as the tender green shoots. I didn't mention May's habit of yelling at me. She wasn't actually yelling at me all the time. She needed only someone to blame for how rotten her life was going. I did do stupid things more often than not. The day I made scalloped onions, I took the onions out of the bag down the basement, where I thought we kept them, and I cut them up, just as May had taught me. And I got cheese and bacon and toast together. I read the recipe about 400 times so as to get it perfectly accurate. Then I put the casserole dish in the 350-degree oven for 40 minutes. It was my job to make supper on the nights May worked at the dry cleaners. I dreaded her coming home because she always walked in the door, took her coat off with a terrible slowness, as if her arms were so tired she wouldn't ever get her wraps untangled from her body, and then shuffled into the kitchen to take stock of my disasters. I could tell she was tired by the way her skin hung on her face, and I didn't improve matters with the smell of char coming from the oven. She couldn't help hollering at me sometimes, wringing that dish towel, saying, "Won't you ever learn to get your task right?" I always said, "I didn't know." And she'd tell me she wished she could order me some new brains. She wondered out loud if scientists could figure out a way to do brain transplants. The time I made scalloped onions, I took them out of the oven. The top was sizzling and golden, and I set the dish on the table. I stepped back to admire it. May was the first one to take a bite because she was always starved after a day at the dry cleaners. She swallowed without chewing, due to extreme hunger. She sat still for 10 seconds, and then she spat what was left in her mouth out on her plate. "You're trying to kill me," she whispered. She couldn't talk too well because she still had food clogged in her throat. She choked. "You're going to poison us." She took the casserole dish and threw all the onions into the garbage pail. There went the whole supper I had planned so carefully. "You show me where you got them onions from," she said. She made me march down the basement stairs with her right on my tail. When I pointed them out, she laughed uproariously, with her hand to her bosom and her eyes closed. She laughed, not out of happiness, but because what I had done proved to her that I was without one sign of intelligence. Those onions were actually tulip bulbs. I didn't tell Aunt Sid the scalloped onion story because I thought if she knew how dumb I was, she wouldn't write to me. Once, though, I got to feeling so sad and useless, I had to tell Miss Finch about the tulip bulbs and other episodes. Miss Finch didn't laugh at me at all. I couldn't believe it. She said it was all right. Anyone could make a mistake like that. "You mean anyone could?" I asked her. And she said, "Yes, that's correct. It was simply a mistake." She had a worried look that would come over her blind face when I imitated May snickering at me. Miss Finch said it wasn't right. She shook her head and said, "No, my dear, that isn't right." Miss Finch, even though she was blind, made a person believe what she was saying, on account of her high forehead and her soft white hair that started way back on her scalp. She might well have worn a crown since a young age that didn't let her hair grow imperfectly. She looked like she was reigning over some little kingdom, with her long nose and all her own teeth. She sat up straight in her bed, and she always had on a clean night jacket decorated with flowers and lace. And she spoke so confidently, saying things like, "No, my dear, that isn't right." Perhaps it was hard for May to see me growing into a woman. Perhaps I reminded her of how she used to be, of what she lost by getting old. When she watched TV, she drooled after Steve McQueen. And maybe she realized all too often, like about every time she looked in the mirror, that Steve McQueen might mistake her for someone dressed up as an ogre for Halloween. It must be strange to keep your strong mind in a body that grows older and weaker and no longer resembles your own image of yourself. Maybe she was already scared about the future, about being left behind in her kitchen while everyone else went out into the world and never came back. She made sure I didn't get notions. There was only one time when I tried to talk to May like the characters in the books by my favorite author, Charles Dickens. We were cleaning the living room, and while I vacuumed, I practiced the sentence over and over. When I switched off the machine, I said, "This room is excessively bare and disorderly, wouldn't you say?" May dropped her dust rag and put her hands on her hips. She looked at me like I was a Jap who had snuck up behind her, something she would never tolerate. "Did a bird shit on your brain?" she asked. When I didn't say anything, she said, "Well, did it?" "No," I said. "Then don't talk like there's a pile of crap in your head." She picked up a rag and started dusting her china dogs, which meant lifting each one carefully and gently wiping their bodies. In Charles Dickens's books, I had to admire the way the meanest enemies spoke to each other, with what seemed to me to be the greatest civility. Sometimes I think that May purposely stopped noticing certain progressions. She never bought me a brassiere at the store. There I am, in my second year of high school, squeezing into little girl undershirts until my nipples showed through. Some of the boys made circles around me, smirking because of my new tits. They said I was behind the other girls developing, which wasn't news to me. Finally, because of the humiliation, I wrote to Aunt Sid. I said, "Dear Aunt Sid, I have a special favor to ask you. It's all because Miss Finch doesn't ever remember to pay me for the job I do at her house. I don't even mind. We are great friends, but I don't have any money I need for certain things. And Ma says if we aren't careful with the funds, we're going to go to the poorhouse. It's her birthday coming up, and I thought I'd get her a bottle of perfume. She got a whiff of some on a lady at the checkout at the grocery store, and she said she sure wished she could smell so good. Isn't that an ideal present for her? Only a bottle the size of a soup can cost about $10. If I could borrow that money from you, I could make Ma's day a real jubilant one. I'll pay you back the minute Miss Finch delivers, I promise. I know you and Ma aren't the best of friends, so you might not want to contribute. I'll understand. Ma said she would let me visit you over her dead body when I suggested a trip to DeKalb. She really burns me up. I bet you're going on another journey this summer. Your luggage must have stickers all over saying the places you stayed at. I sure wish I could visit you sometime. Did you ever see pictures by a man called Picasso over in France? He is on my and Miss Finch's bad list." Aunt Sid wrote right away with $20 inside the envelope. She said to keep 10 for myself and to forget paying her back, period. I spent $2 on some lacy potholders for May's birthday, and the rest was going for brassieres. I know brassieres aren't an important subject to talk about, but back then, they seemed like the hardest trouble in my life. I didn't pay attention to the world, such as the story of the students who got shot down in Ohio because they didn't like the war we were having in Vietnam. I felt sorrier for me without underwear than I did for the poor dead college people. The next Saturday, I walked to Stillwater. I went to the Sears store and bought myself 3 brassieres. They were in boxes with young girls standing in mist with nothing on except the item. Each day, I stuffed one in my lunch sack, and when I got to school, I went into the restroom and put it on. The boys laughed more when they saw I finally had one. They slapped my back to feel it, but I didn't care. I knew I had been smart to get cash from Aunt Sid. When I got home one day, May saw the strap sticking out of my lunch sack. She said, "Where did you get that brassiere?" I stood up tall and said that I wasn't going to be laughed at in school, so I went out and bought it. She didn't even ask me where I got the money. I could tell she was a little impressed. "Well, ain't you grown up all of a sudden?" she said. There was a half smile on her mouth. I wanted to say, "No, Ma, it ain't all of a sudden. If you'd been watching, you could have seen that it's been going on for a year or so." I didn't say anything. I had the feeling I knew what it would be like to be a plant stuck in a pot with a mistress who every now and then remembered to give it a trickle of water. If my nose were taken away, I would have no memories. When I have lain awake all night and my eyes are finally closing, I'll get a whiff of something far off, from another year, another county. Aunt Sid asked me how she could help me sleep, and I thought to myself, "Nose plugs." Sometimes there are only smells. The smell of chickens, the smell of Miss Finch's stale breath and the hard candies by her bed, peppermint, all stuck together with the heat of her house. The smell of Matt's math books where you crack the bindings, they're so new. The smell of May in the kitchen frying the onions. I have smells and also the sound of words. I heard something in church once that made me grin. The Rev declared from his stage, "The dung heap shall smile." I had to crack up in private, thinking about a splat of smelly cow pie with a grin on its face. I kept hearing the words, "The dung heap shall smile," all day long, and I wondered what kind of miracle it would take to make such a substance happy. When I'm lying here thinking about our lives and imagining some of the words May could have spoken, and how it was for her when she was young, and the way she got riled on occasions, I think, maybe May's not so bad, and somehow I got it wrong. It doesn't seem fair. Here I am telling it, and she can't come in and say, "No, that ain't right." There were the times when I knew she was a good person, struggling with something a little bigger than herself. I remember shortly after Elmer left, and she was yelling at me for spilling lemonade on that precious carpet of hers, and then all of a sudden, she was in the chair, her long legs, covered with varicose veins, flapping around. I looked and she was crying with her hand over her eyes, gasping for breath. She told me to come over to her that instant, and she got me all wet. I stood leaning into her, stiff, like something dead. She scared me because I had never seen her cry. She didn't say anything except when she choked, "God damn it," she sobbed, and when it was all over, she removed me from her path and went into the kitchen, sniffling and honking. She blew her nose on her apron. She didn't care. She was extremely nice afterwards, as if crying had purged her of the venom. The funny thing about May was how unpredictable she could be. Every now and then, she went out and bought me a dress, even though we were almost in the poorhouse, and she made me put it on to show her. She admired me in it, like she was some kind of fashion expert. I didn't like the dresses. They were slimy material with flashy checks or flowers, and I felt like I was a sign that said road repairs. But the next minute, after the fashion show where I modeled the new dresses and May oohed and aahed, she barked at me to do the dishes. With the weather, at least, you get storm warnings. Still, I'm probably poisoning the times that she was good to me because of the way things turned out. On some days, I can't help thinking she designed my every move. If she was cleaning the bathroom, she sent me out to use the woods, even in winter. She woke me up in the morning by taking the blankets off the bed. My memory has replaced her with someone completely warty, no teeth, stiff bristles growing out of her chin. And I have to say to myself, think of the happy episodes. Think of your 14th birthday. May baked me a cake in the shape of a lamb, and she even made Matt shut up so she could sing Happy Birthday. She gave me some pink barrettes and a hat and scarf set that she knit. She kept saying she couldn't believe I was 14. She told us exactly how it was when she gave birth. I know the whole story by heart. They knocked her out, and then when she woke up, there I was, a 5-pound red wrinkled baby girl. She said they couldn't decide on my name for the longest time, and so my wrist bracelet said Baby Girl Gray. She told me I cried for hours, and she never got a wink. I can see May lying on the sofa praying for sleep while the thing in the basket screeches. May said what she was going to do was give me 14 kisses for my birthday, and I clamped my teeth down while she did it. I couldn't imagine what possessed her to kiss me. It didn't occur to me that maybe she secretly liked me, but that she couldn't often be enthusiastic because of all the times I let her down. If she got her hopes up, it would be one more example of putting her eggs in the one basket. In grade school, I gave her the ultimate disappointment. It happened when, by some miracle, I made it into the Stillwater All-City Spelling Competition. There were 3 8th grades in my school. I was to represent my class. Matt and Missy Baker, one in their rooms. When I was the only one left up in front of the blackboard during the first elimination, my teacher almost dropped her pants. I was shocked myself and had to look left and right to make sure I was still standing alone. I wrote to Aunt Sid to tell her the good news. I described how we would stand on stage and spell after repeating the word. I told her Miss Finch wanted to help me study, but I said, "Miss Finch, how can you drill me when you can't read?" Miss Finch demanded I leave the word sheets with her, and when I came the next day, her son had recorded all 15 pages on the tape machine. While I sat on the floor, the machine spoke, using all the words in a sentence. I spelled, and Miss Finch corrected me. If I misspelled, she made me do it right 3 times in a row. "Let's get this right," she would say, slapping her hand on the nightstand. There were times I practically hated her for making me drill, and she always remembered every single word I had missed and made me spell them at the end of the session. The day of the spelling bee, May washed one of the navy jumpers I loved, and right before we drove to school for the big night, she gave me a special pen of hers. I was sitting at the table finishing my macaroni, studying the word list frantically, when she loomed over me out of the blue. She started dusting off the front of my jumper like she was cleaning a wall to hang up a masterpiece. "This is an heirloom pen I'm going to let you wear," she said, holding it up to the light. "Your grandmother had it when she was married, and her mother gave it to her. It's for real rare events." She latched it on me. "There, ain't it pretty?" She made her shoulders shimmy while she looked at me. She went crazy when her offspring won their way through contests. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know May owned anything so beautiful. I kept touching the brooch on my way to school, feeling the gold and purple gems. The pen was made in the shape of a daisy, and the stones were the petals. I knew the gift was going to make me lucky. The spelling bee took place in the junior high gym. The 30 contestants were on stage, and the audience sat in the bleachers. Matt, naturally, sat right up front on the stage. Everyone expected him to spell the hardest words with the greatest degree of accuracy, but I was what's known as the dark horse, what they call people who are dumb but astonish the public every once in a while. I had to spell exemplary. When I heard the word, I held my hand over the pen, closed my eyes, thought of the sounds, each one, and spelled. The pen came first. I felt it alive and burning at my throat. Next, I heard the sounds, and then the picture of all the letters flashed up on a board in front of me in white neon, and I could spell the word correctly. Each time I sat back down in my chair, I was breathless with surprise. Other children were falling dead like flies. I had trouble believing I was myself, sitting still in a metal chair, apparently destined to be a winner. When there were 7 people left, I stroked my pen right before I got the word. It was devout. I said, "Please use it in a sentence." And Mrs. Gold said, "The congregation was devout." I spelled it just right. D-E-V-O-U-T. I blew air out of my cheeks on the way back to my seat. I had survived for such a long time. Missy Baker was up next. They gave her exercise. She started to spell it. She lost her place. She was so mad she stamped her foot like a cow that has insects biting its flanks. She said R in 2 places. She was down. Mrs. Golden had to say twice that she was sorry, but to please be seated. Missy could try again next year. It wasn't true. Next year we would be in high school. I wasn't noticing words people got. I was so dizzy, praying to win. Eventually, As a result of my winning, I would become a TV celebrity. They'd send me to Springfield, Illinois, to win the state championship. Then I'd go to Washington, D.C., and beat every boy and girl in the nation. The president would kiss my cheek in person and invite me to live in his house. For lunch, we'd have deviled eggs and slabs of ham and root beer so tall you'd have to stand up to suck at the straw. And there Diane Crawford and Missy Baker would always be, following at my heels like hungry pet slugs, waiting for me to feed them some dirt. When I got up the next time, I stroked the pen, of course. My word was petroleum. It was a long one. I started out slowly, petting the purple gems. I said, P-E-T-R-O-L-E-U-M. One false move and I knew it was all over. I sent a flashy smile in the direction of Missy Baker. She had her head down in her lap while her mother handled her black braids and tried to tell her it was all right. It wasn't all right, not with me up there just about to take the grand prize. I pictured fighting it out with Matt. There were only five of us up on stage, if you don't count Diane Crawford. She was the teacher's helper. She kept track of the spelling lists and marked off the students who went down. Mrs. Golden was on stage, too, giving out words and making up sentences on the spot. I prayed during the next round that I would cream Matt. I told Jesus that I'd believe in him forever and on into eternity if I could only whop Matt just this once. I'd never ask for anything again. In Jesus' name I asked it. Amen. Just as I had gotten my word pejorative, the fire alarm went off. I was so dazed, I thought it was someone screaming at me. I stood straight with my eyes closed, watching my red flaming lips make the sounds. When David Cazola bumped into me and said, "Get moving," I scrambled along behind him. I didn't have the slightest idea how to spell pejorative. I didn't know I was moving or knocking against people. I was hearing myself say, "Please use it in a sentence." I tripped at the door on my shoelace and went sliding down on all fours as I thought, P-E-J. After waiting 10 minutes, we were allowed back in. Mrs. Golden announced to the parents that having to stand up while the alarm went off would tangle up anyone's nerves and that I would be awarded a free round. David Cazola immediately went down on unrequited. Matt was up next. He had to spell the dangling word. He didn't have to stop to think. My turn came, and as I stood up, I felt for my pen, for the luck. I felt my hands went spastic. They flittered all over my chest, my neck, my face. My pen wasn't there anymore. My heart instantly shriveled to the size of a raisin. I had to clutch at my throat and croak, "Wait!" I had to look all around me, back and forth, and back and forth. I was like beagle dogs when they think they smell a squirrel. They don't have control over their body parts or their hoarse yelps. "Miss Gray, please step up to the center," I heard Mrs. Golden say. It was my turn. The free round was over. I felt the tears streaming down my cheeks, and I felt the hole where the pen used to be. I knew my luck couldn't last now. I knew I was being punished for, among other things, wishing Missy Baker a scarred-up face. Sandwich was my word. It was easy, but I stalled for time. I said, "Please use it in a sentence." I held my throat like my head wasn't screwed on tight. "You have a delicious sandwich for lunch," Mrs. Golden said. I could hear the parents laughing at me for asking for a sentence. Sandwich. I tried to pronounce it so carefully. There was no hope for me since my vocal cords had decided to change jobs, see if they liked being earlobes instead. I whispered the letters. S, Fandwitch. For one second, I thought I had it right. I wasn't punished after all. But Mrs. Golden said, "I'm sorry. Please be seated." When I got to May, way up at the top of the bleachers, I was crying so hard it was impossible to stop. She took one look at me and said, "Where's my pen?" "I don't know," I wailed at her, so that everyone heard me. I was hoping she saw it fall off of me somewhere along the line. The latch on it was too weak for fire alarms and scraping your knees and praying and spelling. I could tell May was dying to get her hands on a dish towel so she could wring it. She picked violently at the knees of the orange slacks she always wore. I couldn't figure out how the pen had fallen off. Plus, I went down on Sandwich. I wanted her to strangle me right then, get my life over with. Afterwards, while everyone cleared out, I sat on the bleacher with my head down and felt a hand at my back. I didn't recognize the feel of it, and I had to look up. It was Aunt Sid, come 40 miles to see me spell. When I saw her, I burst into tears all over again. "You were wonderful," she said. If I had the words, I would have told her that lie stank worse than a pig fart. I couldn't speak to her. I heard nothing she said. When she was gone, I noticed that there was a bag on my lap. I picked it up and carried it to the car. All I wanted was May to be proud of me, to be her smartest daughter, and for Matt to turn a hideous green color at my stardom. And what did I do but go down on the easiest word in the English language and lose May's favorite jewel, worth millions of dollars? Afterwards, I had looked everywhere. I only saw Diane Crawford laughing at me, at the way I crawled around, feeling the floor like I didn't have sight. Matt was the first alternate. He went down on aforementioned. He must have temporarily slipped a cog. Still, he ended up going to Springfield because the winner busted his collarbone at the last minute. That's the kind of luck Matt has. On the way home, May said one thing. She turned around to me at the stop sign and said, "I'm never going to give you nothing valuable again." Later that night, I went out to the plateau and stared into the sky, thinking how I didn't care about the gems. I didn't care about the cassette recorder Aunt Sid had placed on my lap, including 5 full tapes. I was going to pin stars on my chest, real ones. I'd walk into the house with a huge shining star on me. It'd blind May, and she would fall to her knees saying how sorry she was. One Saturday, a year after the spelling bee, I was over at Miss Finch's house, even though I didn't have to visit her on the weekends. There was something about her, with no eyes to see, that made it seem all right to tell her thoughts. We were listening to Emma. I started telling Miss Finch I wished I could be in that book. The people were so funny, and even the bad characters weren't too terrible. We were talking about their faults a little, and I told her that compared to May, with the sharp flat back of her hand, and Elmer, who was about as emotional as a corpse, the English people didn't do anything very terrible. It seemed like having pride was the biggest sin back then, and not knowing yourself through and through. Miss Finch said she wanted to hold my hand, so I let her. Hers was all scaly, like a fish's back. She said she could tell I had good thoughts. Good thoughts, she said, and that I shouldn't ever let people put me down, that I had to try and rise above any meanness I saw. She asked me if I told my Aunt Sid the things I told her, and I said, sure, even though I was lying. She put her fingers on my face, and she said that she knew I was beautiful. I felt something far down inside me, the size of a pinpoint, flicker, and then glow for a minute. Chapter 6. I have to go backwards one more time to a certain Sunday when the Rev called upon us in church. It was one of the children's Sundays when Matt and I were small. We had to go up to the pulpit to hear the words from our Rev. I watched his brown shoes tapping the green carpet while he sat there with us, discussing how great it is for people to have friends. Better yet, best friends. He had a mustache that didn't amount to anything, and places on his cheeks where it looked like he'd hurt himself shaving. He said that sometimes a good friend surprised a person with their generosity and kindness. He told us about Lazarus in the Holy Bible, and how Lazarus was just a bag of dry bones, and then bingo, Jesus comes along and puts him back together. Puts skin on him, restores his beard and the creases in his wrists, and makes him breathe. The Rev said Lazarus was lucky to have such a good friend in Jesus. He mentioned that the Lord could be our friend also. For a while after that story, I tried to get in touch with Jesus, but it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. You have to create him in your mind's eye, and I already had my mind's eye cluttered with owls flapping their quiet wings and frogs calling through mud. Still, when I saw bones of sheep out in the pasture, a whole skeleton picked clean, I imagined it all of a sudden covered back up with wool and eyeballs and nostrils, and I ached for the Son of God to come on over and do his magic. That old skeleton was Gloria, one of my favorite sheep. Now I'd have to say that Lazarus story is about the craziest section in the book. I remember when the Rev was talking about friends, how he looked at Matt and me sitting together like we belonged, like we were supposed to be playmates. The Rev didn't know that my brother lived in an entirely different landscape, that Matt thought he was a handsome oak tree vigorously climbing up towards the light, while May and I were scrawny mulberry bushes. By the time we were in high school, Matt was fairly handsome, according to the girls in my class, despite his outbreaks of pimples. Matt didn't seem to mind having acne. He probably thought each pimple was a national treasure. He played tennis on the team. Doubles was his specialty, since he cooperated with other boys. I always thought the coach must have been hard up for players, because whenever I watched the games, all Matt did was shift from foot to foot, leaning over, gripping his racket. I didn't ever see him take a shot. It was always the boy in the back. Nonetheless, he was popular, which made May awfully glad. She was thankful he hadn't gone straight to college from kindergarten, because then she couldn't have rooted for him at the tennis match. He was the youngest in our class, but you couldn't tell because of the fancy sports jacket decorated in the school's blue and white. The jacket had a patch on it that meant he was a hot shot. Most of all, however, everyone raved about his math. Our Matt was a wizard. They drove him to Chicago for contests, and it seemed like he was always taking exams so he could go to college at a great distance from Honey Creek. They sent him to a math summer camp at the University of Chicago. You should have seen May mourning for him for 2 months. She gave up putting her hair in rollers and wearing fresh aprons, plus cooking food a human could stand to eat. The principal at our school, Dr. Hecht, was apparently in love with Matt, judging by the number of times he called our home. All of the faculty had plans for my brother. Matt came home each day with a calculator attached to his belt, in case he needed to figure something out quickly, I guess, like an emergency. He went into his room, came out for supper, and then went back to his desk. That's my brother Matt. We were supposed to be friends. We were supposed to surprise each other with kindness and generosity. When he looked at my face, I turned away, because I could see him scrutinizing me for signs of life. I felt shy around him, because I knew his brains were tremendous. Shy isn't the precise word. I felt smaller and meaner than a bee sting. May desperately wanted to be his favorite person. She reminded me of our gray cat who never died. She always kept living, and each year she had scores of kittens. There she was every time you looked, with a juicy mouse in her chops, calling to her brood. The kittens were usually playing with their tails or going crazy watching an ant. They couldn't have cared less about their mother and her carefully planned meals. May tried to pet Matt sometimes. She'd get up from the supper table, and I could see her wanting to touch his hair. And if she did it, gingerly, he shook his head like she'd spilled hot grease on top of him. He mumbled at her with his mouth full of tuna casserole if she asked him, "How was your day?" Matt, with the pimples and the jacket, didn't talk to us, and I was quiet because I didn't have usable words on my tongue. I saved them all for Miss Finch. May had to do the talking solo if she wanted company. She sat at the head of the table in her extra-large fuzzy green sweater that looked like a bloated zucchini consuming her. She told us about everyone in town and what all their children were doing. Matt and I ate without uttering a sound while May went on about Mrs. Brierly's daughter Pamela and her marriage to the banker. The newlyweds went down to a hotel in Rockford with a big old bubbling bathtub in their room. I couldn't imagine Pamela and that pocked-faced banker sitting in a boiling hot tub, coming out with their flanks all red. When we were in high school, May worked at the dry cleaners. We had our land rented out, although May and I continued to raise chickens. I fed them and shoveled out the hen house, and May took the eggs on a route. She sold dozens and dozens to Negroes. She didn't like it if people were a different color. She drove about 60 miles twice a week, taking eggs to feed people she didn't think should live on the earth. It slayed her, serving the black ladies who had more money than she did. We didn't have cows or sheep anymore, because they were too much work without a man around. Matt didn't do chores. He was busy exploring all the avenues in his head. I knew one truth about May back then, without putting words to it. She was so lonesome. You could tell it in every movement she made. She never sat still, and when she moved, she dragged herself from place to place. She couldn't bear to think about how empty she was. She sure needed Jesus to come breathe life into her. There were moments, too, when I could see May feeling sorry for me. I would catch her looking over at me, her head tilted, her eyes a little wider and sadder than usual. How pitiful I was made her even more lonesome. I averted my eyes when she stared my way. I couldn't stand the hope she had for me. She told me about the dances and parties at our school. They showed all the queens in the paper being crowned and then kissed by their consorts. I knew she wished I was in the paper, too. They photographed all the girls in fluffy skirts and fitted tops. If I went to the dances, I might be sorely tempted to sink my teeth into their flesh, and then they'd put me in the dog pound. One fall after supper, when I was a junior, May asked me if I didn't want to go to the homecoming dance, and I got scared because it was within her power to make me do it. I felt myself looking like a cow when it's being led somewhere it doesn't want to go, bugging out its eyes so the bloodshot white showed. I could see myself in some dress not fitting my top, and no one asking me to dance, not once the whole night, and all the other girls are queen. "I don't want to go, Ma," I said, "and no one is going to ask me either." "That's what every girl thinks," she said, mopping up the table. "You wait. Some day someone will beg you to go." "Never," I said under my breath. I didn't say that I would pass out dead if it ever happened. Then May started telling me that when she was my age, she loved to dance. She wiggled her fanny and took me into the living room by the wrist. She trotted around, moving the TV out of the way and pushing the chairs to the side. She grabbed my grandmother's handmade broom, the antique May always said was especially valuable because of the walnut handle. She started waltzing with it. She was graceful, and she smiled at the broom awfully moony. I thought I was going to be embarrassed, but she looked so idiotic and happy I had to laugh. "Teach me to do that, Ma," I said. I wanted to look moony just like her. So she went and turned the radio on and yanked me into position and said, "Okay, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. May told me where to put my feet, how to be light, how to feel my bones dissolve into thin air. We worked at it for a good half hour. When we were taking a breather, she said next we'd learn the foxtrot. She said I was getting the hang of dancing." We didn't see Matt standing in the hall watching us. We were concentrating, but giggling also. May didn't call me a stupid. She told me I must have her feet because I was catching on so quickly. She said, "You're getting it. Now relax your shoulders." We were floating around the living room, skimming the floor. But when May saw the expression on Matt's face, she got flustered. When she saw the jacket that says Varsity, she dropped her hands from my waist. He looked at us like we were a couple of perverts. He didn't need to say one thing. He shook his head, went into the bathroom, slammed the door. May frowned and turned the radio off. She walked upstairs. I heard her bed rattle as she climbed in it and adjusted the covers over her head. Sometimes I dream we are dancing. We're wearing dresses that look like they're made out of heads of Q-tips. Our skin is scrubbed clean to perfection. We don't have chapped elbows, and I'm on the homecoming court. After the dance, we teach each other hobbies. I show her some of the blind tapes, books I think she'd like, my favorites, by the author Charles Dickens. And she can make my feet do steps that aren't invented yet. We don't even touch the floor. We trade secrets and guard them. Sometimes I feel that I'm only just ready to start my life. I know what I need to live it 100 times better. As far as I can see, no one is out there waiting for me with a ticket that says, "Try it again." I'll probably really figure out exactly how to be alive right when I'm gasping for my last breath. In those days, I used to look around myself, trying to see farther than Honey Creek. I couldn't see much beyond the cemetery, and I understood that I wasn't ever going to go anywhere unless something explosive happened, such as a war in our state. I was going to be cooped up in a building with rows and rows of metal lockers and bad light in the halls and drinking fountains with green gum sitting on the porcelain like toads for years to come. When I watched the news on TV with May at supper, we saw people getting bombed over in Vietnam. They were having battles while we ate our food. I used to imagine Honey Creek going up in flames and smoke, and I wondered who would survive, and if they would share their food, and if the low would still be low, or if the bombings would upset the pecking order. I was still scared of everyone at school. There were two boys who menaced me. I won't say their names. They know who they are. Maybe the teachers kept me in the dumb classes because I never opened my mouth and they forgot I was alive. They didn't know that I was like the mice who come out after dark, squeaking and pattering. About the only time I spoke in school was the time I told Miss Dakin I thought Hitler had some good points, and she stared me down until I changed my mind. In most cases, I couldn't speak about history or math because I was dreaming about blind tapes. I couldn't do math no matter how hard I stared at the page, and everyone thought to themselves, "Why aren't you like your brother Matt?" When Miss Taylor said that very sentence to me out loud, she was exasperated because I could not do long division. I ripped up my math sheets and bit my tongue so I wouldn't cry. I got an F. When we had to read books in school, I never understood them like we were supposed to. My eyes hurt from looking at the pages all the time, and when the teachers asked me what the books were about, I couldn't say in one single sentence. I seemed to feel the meaning with my body rather than my head. When I got promoted to the regular English class, my teacher asked me what I thought were the major themes in The Great Gatsby. My face heated up and turned to steam. I saw the rich people floating before me, very fat on being rich, and they were empty, And there was the big old billboard with the glasses watching over the highway like it thought it was Jesus Christ. When Mr. Davidson asked me what the book meant, the only words I heard were, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, now relax your shoulders. He wrote, "See me," on all my school themes. He said I had serious problems with the language. I had to go in at lunchtime and sit by him at his desk. I had to smell his perfume and watch the crust of shaving cream behind his ear. He always took his glasses off and wiped his eyes. My themes made him so tired he couldn't stand to think about them. The whole paper was covered with red ink. There wasn't one place to start correcting. Finally, he demoted me to my old class. He decided he couldn't save me. I asked Miss Finch, what would you think if I joined the Army after high school? I was certain they didn't send girls over to Vietnam because the posters at the post office showed the women at typewriters and switchboards. They spoke of careers and travel. I asked Miss Finch, do you think I could get into the U.S. Army? She told me the superiors made a person do 1,000 sit-ups and push-ups and run around, and that women as well as men were taught to handle guns. She said the Army was a ghastly place, unfit for man or beast. I couldn't imagine what else I might end up doing except wiping eggs and selling them to people who saw the sign on the road. I guess the best thing I could do was sniff the air and say how good it smelled. When I was in the last years of high school, May got a girlfriend. That's what she called her, only Mrs. Foote was over the hill. She was about 48. She was definitely not a girl. She first came as an egg customer, and gradually she got very chummy with May. She lived down the road in a house that was more run down than ours, with her three children and her husband. He had weak kidneys, so he couldn't work. Mrs. Foote had gray short hair that was so stiff it stuck off the back of her head like a slide. It looked slippery, too. She had several black moles on her face, and breasts so big, if they had hands at the end of them, they might be useful. They could wipe silver, or sew on buttons. Her teeth had wide black spaces between them. If you were an organism in her mouth, you'd have to be able to jump pretty far, going from tooth to tooth. Wherever she went, her fat son followed. He bossed everyone around and thought he knew as much as Dr. Heck, the school principal, possibly even more. He had sisters at home who were always getting into trouble, stealing and running away. He said his sisters were loose. He told me he whipped them, but he was lying. He was too lazy to hurt people. Mrs. Foote wore flowered dresses that zipped tight up the front, and an apron with a hammer, her flashlight, and a dust rag in the pocket. Her nylons had run so wide I couldn't figure out why she even bothered to wear them, and her shoes were holy. I could see her broken soles because she always put her feet up on a chair. She said she had to rest her swollen veins. She had probably the shortest, fattest legs in the state of Illinois. If she wasn't a person, you'd laugh at the shape you saw out there in nature. She was a fixture in our kitchen in the afternoons when I came home from stringing up the blind tapes. May didn't ordinarily smoke, but with her girlfriend, she lit up about 5 cigarettes one after the next. The place smelled like a murky tavern. May exhaled as if she thought she was a knockout. She blew smoke up to the ceiling like a movie star. Mrs. Foote and May became friends because Mrs. Foote had problems she couldn't solve. She had to tell someone about them. For instance, her girl hurt someone on the road when she was driving around smashed. Mrs. Foote didn't know what to do about her children, so she always cried with her head down on the table. But the beauty of it was May going over to Mrs. Foote and patting her on the shoulder and saying, "Now, now." When I was in the living room folding laundry and watching the news, I could hear them in there, Mrs. Foote sniffling and May saying, "It's okay, it's okay." Sometimes I got little flashes of understanding. All of a sudden, I knew what the Rev had been saying all those years ago when he talked about how friends are people who can surprise you with kindness. May was a friend both ordinary and miraculous. What cracked me up was the way Mrs. Foote thought May had a TV show life, with her smart boy winning science fairs and math games, and a girl who didn't do stunts, such as practically killing people at 3 in the morning. May didn't say to her best friend, "I'm just as miserable as you." Instead, she acted as if she had been guaranteed a trouble-free existence by Mr. J. Christ. Probably, compared to Mrs. Foote's Daisy, I was the world's best-behaved high school girl. But Daisy was spectacularly beautiful. She was in my grade, and she had dark hair that curled around her face, and big black eyes with thin, feathery, plucked eyebrows, and she put green makeup on her lids, piles of it, with silvery specks, so she looked like she was from somewhere else. The moon, for example. Everybody couldn't help looking at her when she walked straight down the hall, not turning to see a single person. She was 2 years behind in school, because she didn't care about anything except boys. Some said even the football coach couldn't help himself, and that he took Daisy to the Rainbow Motel. One spring night when I was 16, I heard banging at the door. I lay stiff and alert in bed. Probably somebody was coming to kill us. I listened to May go downstairs, and pretty soon there was the noise of Mrs. Foote blabbering. I heard the wind moving out between the wide spaces of her teeth. Naturally, she had her son Randall along. He was so fat, if he sat on a worm on a rock, it would make a fossil in about 5 minutes. Then scientists wouldn't have to wait 1 million years. I went downstairs because I couldn't help it. I was curious. No one said anything to me. Randall was the only one who glanced at me standing in my nightgown.